Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 775. Rick Morris and Ben Chu are your FDH Lounge dignitaries today, breaking down the 2016-2017 NBA season that has just started. We're going to be taking a look at it here in the very early going. Ben, of course, also managing editor of that NBALotteryPick.com. You can check out all the ongoing great content there, and we'll be getting into another project that Ben has been working on is basketball-oriented. We'll be getting into that as well in the course of things here today. But, Ben, good to have you back on, my man. Looking forward to breaking down this young season with you.
Well, I appreciate it always, Rick, but I was very confused. I thought this was a Tales from the Crypt episode. It's cold. It's rainy out here. A lot of people looking like the Crypt Keeper out here, man.
Well, you're out there in Portland. I am in the city of champions, Cleveland, and strange how our weather is kind of mirroring each other. Not so much rainy today, but, yeah, just getting to be kind of cold and autumn-like, and just need the Indian summer to come back in time for Game 6 of the World Series tomorrow. But I want to say also, too, publicly, I'm going to heed your advice. My Cavs Chinese New Year shirt, which I never broke out until the last three games of the NBA Finals last June. We know how that worked out. I'm breaking it out for Game 6 of the World Series, pairing it with my Chief Wahoo cap, but I'm taking your advice, my man.
All right. Hopefully that works, because if it doesn't work, well, you guys might be in trouble in a Game 7, even with your guys' pitching in the recent games. So.
Well, yeah. And would that I had any kind of guaranteed gimme for Game 7 clothing-wise. So wearing it for Game 6 gives me time to adjust in case there's not transferative properties. There were not transferative properties when the great Sean Powell went for the World Welterweight Championship over the summer on national TV here. I was sad to see that did not come about, but I alluded to it, and that's where we pretty much, I think, have to start. City of Champions, it all started, I guess we could say, with Stipe Miocic in the spring, moved on from there to the Lake Erie Monsters with the Calder Cup, first since 1964, and on to the Cleveland Cavaliers, the main Cleveland sports topic of today, specifically. Getting into that, and we saw last week the ring and banner ceremony that really just kind of culminated, I'd say, a lifetime's worth of memories. You go back to Game 7 itself and the 20,000 people coming out to the airport to see the team when they came back in town. 1.3 million people for the parade. And the ring and banner ceremony really sort of puts the exclamation point on it, moves us on to the new season. But you have to think from a Cavs fan perspective like myself, what you've seen thus far is exactly what you'd want to see. Ty Lue, this is the first training camp that he had with them as head coach. We forget for as great as the season started, but they had to adjust to Ty Lue, and he had to adjust to them sort of on the fly. So you get into it now, and you would think, you would hope, they made some off-season moves here. Mike Dunleavy coming in. They only really kind of tinkered around the margins, but Birdman is now in the mix here to be given a little bit of rim protection. So you would hope that they would be looking better than they looked last year during the regular season, where it was kind of an iffy kind of thing at times here. And thus far, that's exactly what it's been, Ben. This team has looked dominant.
Right, and as you know very well, Rick, the Eastern Conference is not exactly at its peak right now, but just judging so far from the beginning couple games of the season, they are – at least you would say a much more efficient offensive team than they were last season, even going in where you have, you know, an MVP candidate like LeBron James and all these other talented guys around him. I would say that this team is a much better offensive team than last year, which will probably play to their strengths if they have to face a team, let's say, like the Clippers or the Golden State Warriors in the finals.
Exactly. And in terms of offensive efficiency, one of the things here, and again, one of the prime freakout points for the Cavs fan base over a period of time is Kevin Love and being on the max contract, and there's a lot of people, unfortunately, that have always kind of obsessed on the fact that you haven't gotten his Minnesota level of production here, which is ridiculous because he's never going to be 26-12 as a third option. I mean, he can approach the 12 rebounds, but the 26 part of it is going to be a lot tougher. This is a thing where I said over the summer, and again, I'm going to put my bias in here to begin with. I was a big Kevin Love fan before he got to Cleveland. I've always been a proponent of stretch fours, sweet shooting big men. They're kind of like unicorns. There's not a lot of big men who can really shoot. I like to have one on my team if I can. So I argued over the summer when a lot of people were saying, oh, trade him. There was a lot of panic stuff going on when Golden State got Durant. I said, the way that the Cavs can most dramatically improve next year is to edge closer to getting the Minnesota Kevin Love. Again, you're never going to get the guy in full because the opportunities aren't going to be there. But there's been a little bit thus far of playing him with the second unit, making him the top scorer on the floor, try to get him into the flow that way. And Ty Lue, he had good ideas that he implemented last year during the season. I got to think that was a big part of the focus of his summer, is how can I continue to unlock K-Love? Would you agree that when you're talking about the offensive efficiency of the Cavs, that's got to be right about at the top of the list for this year?
I would think it's near the top of the list, or it's close enough to the top of the list where it will matter overall. The thing with Kevin Love is that, and I think the perception is with a lot of people, based off of his numbers in Minnesota, is that he was a high-volume shooter and a high-volume rebound guy. And to be honest, there were instances when he was the best player on that team. And when you're the best player on a team, you have to do what you can. And you're going to put up gaudy stats. Like, we'll use the Russell Westbrook example this year. When you're that, when you're the best player on your team, you're going to have to put up numbers. And I think when you're a star moving to a situation where you get to play with other stars, you're not on, you're not Wally reliant on having to do 28 and 10 every night. But the one thing that's always been good with Kevin Love is his ability to shoot the three and his ability to make plays happen on fast breaks without let passes, because that was one of the things that the Cavs, as you can understand, at periods of time last year, they, during the Blatt era, they were a good offensive team, but the problem was that they never ran. Even though you had guys like LeBron, you had guys like Shumpert, JR, Kyrie, You have elite athletes on that squad, and it's all, you're only going to get better with, you know, Kay Felder coming in at some point during the season, and Jordan McRae, who played well for their summer league team, and is going to give them possibly some scoring off the bench if anyone, including JR or Shumpert, is unable to play.
I totally agree. I'm very excited about Kay Felder, the absolute steal of him in the second round. It's just amazing how many people I talked to over the summer. Like, almost everybody I talked to, I asked them, are you watching Kay Felder and Jordan McRae in summer ball? And everybody was. And I dare say that it wouldn't have been the case in years past. So people did not want to stop watching Cavs basketball on June 19th when they won the championship last year. But you talk about Felder, you get to the guy that he's going to be backing up, a guy who, again, I'm biased, big fan of his personally, have been from the day that he came into the league. A lot of people thought the Cavs should have taken Derek Williams. Those people have faded into the background very quickly. I said all along, you want Kyrie Irving. Love this young man. Love his game. Taking big steps towards being a transcendent talent, becomes the fourth player in history to win an NBA championship and a gold medal in the same calendar year. And, again, the game-winning shot in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. So this is a guy where, again, we're not really even at the point yet, I wouldn't think, where we can start to see the passing of the torch from LeBron to Kyrie, because LeBron is going to remain the dominant player on this team minimum 2-3 years at this point here. But talk about where we're headed, Ben, with Kyrie and the part that this season is going to play in that eventual transformation.
Right. Well, the one thing that a lot of people don't necessarily realize, during his first two seasons in the league, including his rookie season, he was more of a perimeter-oriented scorer who could make good passes to, you know, get easy baskets. But the major thing that I've been seeing recently, especially even in the preseason too, when he did play, is he's getting to the basket a lot easier than he used to. And I think at some point, he's going to try to mold himself. The only guy I can really think of that kind of reminds me of him early on was, like, is the early Minnesota Timberwolves, Stephon Marbury. when you have a guy that can make big shots, can break someone off the dribble and get to the basket, that's going to be something that's going to be important. And to be honest, even if you see LeBron and Kevin Love retires earlier, if anything happens along those lines, Kyrie will still have a very solid supporting cast. If you assume McRae comes back, Tristan Thompson will still be around. So they still have a lot of pieces, and especially within the East, where pretty much it's a hodgepodge of teams at the top and pretty much everyone else. You really, if you're Cleveland, you just have to hold on and try and make sure that you get yourself decent playoff positioning, and you should be fine.
Oh, absolutely. And let's talk about that, because that's one of the focuses coming into the year. I know that a lot of people, certainly I'll tell you this, nobody in the Cavs fan base minds the notion of the Cavs basically having a bye to the NBA Finals for next year. But around the league, people would at least like to believe that that's not necessarily the case. Now, you look at what they've done the last 2 years in the playoffs in the East, 12-2 both years. 2 years ago, 12-2 without Kevin Love for much of it and without Kyrie Irving for at least some of it. So that shows you the scenario right there, that LeBron can pretty much carry this cast, which, again, I think is better than it was at this point 2 years ago. He can pretty much carry this cast through to the NBA Finals, where, again, the Cavs would probably be roadkill for the Spurs or the Warriors if they didn't have the other members of the Big Two in there. But you and I were talking about this off air. The only scenario that exists is, God forbid, LeBron is a guy who's held up throughout the course of his whole career. If this is the year something happens to him, he goes down, he's not in there. I would argue the Cavs, at worst, are still a 50-50 pick against the field. If you're looking at Kyrie, Love, J.R. Smith, guys who have now won a championship, know what it takes, have that extra gear, I think, now that they've been able to do that. Tristan Thompson, assuming that he doesn't get too blinded by the whole Kardashian scheme of things here. You've got a team that I would say is probably 50-50 against the entire field to make it out of the East, even if, God forbid, something happened to LeBron. How do you see it?
Right. I think you're more bullish on it than I am. But at this point, I think the perception for everyone is that Cleveland is probably going to make it to the finals, barring significant injury to multiple stars on their team. The only other teams you can really even discuss that could possibly make it would be Toronto with DeRozan and Lowry. Their team is much deeper than last year, and it's going to be interesting to see how they use guys like CM and Poeltl. And, you know, the issue for Toronto is that they're still reliant on jumpers, and they're reliant on Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan both playing well to win. And
right,
I'll buy it. They'll at some point make that jump. The problem for them is that I think DeRozan's is essentially a perimeter player, and Lowry is a perimeter player too. You really need a guy that can get you easy baskets, and we're gonna see what happens with that. Boston's another team that's very interesting, but I don't think they have enough offense, even with the acquisition of Al Horford. And Chicago, I think, is pretty much the dark horse team out of everyone in the East, because alibi, you have an older Wade, an older Rondo, a more improved version of Jimmy Butler. I like how strangely their roster is composed. You got a lot of good veteran talent, but you also have got a lot of good young guys like Bobby Portis, Cristiano Felicio, Nikola Mirotic. Well, Nikola Mirotic isn't necessarily young, but he's young by NBA standards. So they have a lot of talent.
Right.
They just have to figure out a way to put it all together. But at this point, like you said, I think barring, some sort of game plan that takes LeBron out of a game, which doesn't seem to be very likely, I would assume that Cleveland has pretty much an 85-90% chance of making it to the finals this year again.
Oh, exactly. And I would
say
that I am bullish about the prospects of the Cavs making it through, even if something happened to LeBron. And that is almost 100% because of my it might be too strong of a word, but contempt for the rest of the East. It's not so much that I think that the Cavs are a super team that could bowl through, because, again, the Cavs would be roadkill trying to get through the Western Conference all the way through without LeBron. But in the East, you've got, again, you look at media narratives. I mean, one of the more absurd ones is the Knicks, with everything that they did in the offseason, that they might actually comprise some kind of a winning combination here. But the media has also really pushed the whole narrative of, maybe Boston's about to take the next step here. And as you said, also the Bulls, too, with a really kind of colorful assortment of parts. But again, I keep coming back to Fred Hoiberg has struggled to implement his vision with the Bulls with a roster that was much more suited to doing so. So it's an excellent
right.
coaching staff that he's got there, and they're going to apply themselves to the task completely. But, you know, chemistry has been one of their bigger elusive things in the past, and I can't think it's going to be any easier for them this time around. So it's the field in the Eastern Conference. If I would say that I'm bullish on the Cavs to make it through almost no matter what, it would just be you can't beat something with nothing. And I look at the rest of the East and I go, where's that team going to come from? As you said, Toronto's probably the best bet, though.
Toronto, I mean, I would like to say, I know you're more bullish in that narrative because you're in Cleveland.
Right.
But I think if there's a scenario, if LeBron was to go down, Toronto would have a pretty much a 50-50 chance of winning. And, I mean, Boston, I think,
okay.
if, considering Brad Stevens is one of the best coaches in the NBA, I think they could make it work. But the problem is, as you know, too, the X factor is LeBron. If LeBron is there, they're most likely going to make it to the NBA Finals, barring massive injury to him. Because even everything else is really a punter's chance. In Chicago, I think they're a good team, and it's going to be interesting. The one thing I can say about Chicago that some of these other teams do not have, Toronto and Boston, for alibi, their depth and their ability to score, they don't have a primetime guy that can close out a game, and at least Chicago now has that in Wade.
Right. But when you're looking at the rest of the conference here, just in terms of teams to maybe make some noise, potentially even sneak into the second round in terms of a best-case scenario, when you're talking past the teams that we've already looked at here, some of the younger teams in the East are really kind of intriguing to me. So interested to know who among those teams kind of jumps out more at you. Van Gundy, with everything that he's got going on in Detroit, they kind of took a little bit of a step forward last year. Indiana has really done some intriguing kind of things here and bringing in Jeff Teague to work with these guys at the point. Milwaukee, a team that I thought massively underachieved last year. Granted, their talent is young, but, again, I can't believe there wasn't more heat on Jason Kidd for the way that team played. Charlotte was a team that had more success than maybe some people thought last year. Washington was a team that didn't, quite frankly, and that a lot of people had penciled in for the playoffs, and they didn't make it. So out of this grab bag of some of the younger teams in the East scratching and clawing to try to get ahead, who are the ones that you think are the best prospects for this year?
Right. The popular pick for pretty much everyone in the offseason when I was reading through multiple, media sources was Indiana. Because you have Paul George, they acquired Jeff Teague, Miles Turner is coming into his own. They got Nate McMillan, the former Blazer and Sonics head coach. So that you would think that they, in terms of their offense, they're going to find a way to make it work. My only issue is that I think their depth is meh, to be brutally honest, and I'm not a huge Jeff Teague fan, even though I think he's an elite point guard in the association. It's just it's. I still feel like all the stuff that happened with the Hawks, it pretty much went with Jeff Teague. Whether that's fair or unfair, that's pretty much how it is. Detroit is
okay.
the interesting candidate, I would say, here, because they really played Cleveland 3 out of the 4 games really well. They had chances to
yes.
win if something broke their way. The real question for them is that under Stan Van Gundy's tutelage, are they going to make that jump? Because they do have the players on the outside like Caldwell Pope. I know Reggie Jackson's coming back from an injury still, but he's still a very underrated guard. You got Drummond. They got a lot of quality players, Tobias Harris. You got a lot of good talent there. The real question is how are you going to mesh it together and how's it going to work? The one-foot team that I think is probably going to make the playoffs after not making the playoffs is probably Washington. If Beal and Wall both stay healthy, I think Scott Brooks knows what he's going to need to be able to do. They're not exactly the sexiest team in the Eastern Conference, but they have guys that can play. And if Beal and Wall can stay healthy, they should be able just to fall into the playoffs at that point.
You would think so. I mean, it's a top-heavy roster, but, boy, those are very, very nice pieces. As we head to the Western Conference, some would say the biggest story of the entire year. We led with the Cavs, but some would say that a lot of people in the media, I think, would say that Golden State's the biggest story of the year with bringing in Kevin Durant, now the almost unprecedented Big Four, if you want to look at it that way, in the NBA, sort of an uneven start to the season, and that might be kind, actually, the way that they got curb stomped by San Antonio in the opener and have won two games since, albeit still working and really almost kind of struggling to find their way, as Steve Kerr has kind of indicated. So when you look at Golden State, again, a team that did sort of hollow itself out inside because their ability to rim protect against the Cavs was one of the things that really frustrated the Cavs through the first series and a half of the NBA Finals when they met. And then without Andrew Bogut there, it was really a different story for the Cavs in the last three games. So subsequently here, putting all their money on trying to be the greatest team ever at what they were already one of the greatest teams at, with that offensive just kind of explosion and flourish. How do you see this working out? Because they do obviously have some flaws, particularly defensively, particularly inside. Offensively, nobody in the history of the game quite possibly might be their match. So how do you see that playing out here? There's a lot of people that were ready to just give them the NBA championship before the season, but from what we've seen of San Antonio, maybe the Western Conference isn't even a gimme.
I mean, I think the narrative that everyone's trying to pull is that it's a common narrative. You have a really good team that won 73 games last season, adding one of the premier talents in the NBA to their roster. The perception is that they're going to play really well, but we also already saw what happened before when three elite players came together in Miami with LeBron, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade. They had their growing pains. They made it to the finals, but they lost to Dallas in pretty much a heartbreaking series for them. So it's going to take some time to figure out how they're going to mesh appropriately. I think right now it's really tough to tell how they're going to play out. A lot of people were penciling them in for 70 wins. I don't see it. Last year, the reason why they were able to get to that mark was very early on in the season through that insane winning streak to start. They were pretty much beating up on powder puff teams that had no idea mm-hmm. that they could do. There were literally points in the beginning of last season where teams after the first quarter would be already pretty much done. And I think what happened is during the transitional points of the season, ultimately the real two sort of jumping off points to how you were able to defend the Warriors came from Jason Kidd when Milwaukee beat them for the first time, and then San Antonio when they beat them. I think Golden State will figure out what they need to do. They should be the number one seed, barring any craziness in the West, but I think they're probably going to make it through, but I think the whole narrative gap that everyone thought there was between Golden State and everyone else was a little bit overdone.
Yeah, we've really kind of seen that thus far. And that aforementioned opener that they had against San Antonio, which to me from a marketing perspective was kind of curious because you only get a couple of these games per year. And to use one on opening night, which is already a huge night, I thought was really kind of interesting. But the way that the Spurs have played thus far, their own rejiggering in the offseason, Pau Gasol comes in, Tim Duncan goes out, and that's something that at this point in time probably has more impact on the spirit and the morale of the team than the actual on-court performance of it, because his role had kind of faded, understandably, in recent years as he got older. So San Antonio just does it year in and year out, retooling on the fly. You shed a part here, a part there. You bring in new guys. They lose David West, but again, yeah, you can't say it was that much of a loss based on his contributions of a year ago. Kawhi Leonard looking like he is going to be an MVP candidate. You got to think that it's going to take him and Aldridge just playing out of their skulls throughout the season here if they're going to have a chance to topple Golden State. But how do you like San Antonio's odds here in what looks like it could be a two-horse race at the top of the West?
I think the perception was in the offseason of San Antonio's old. I think their time has finally come. But I think one of the things we all kind of forgot was, I think for some bizarre reason, most of us thought Tim Duncan was better than he was. Because if we're being brutally honest here, he had a really good final season in the NBA, but it was way below what his standard would be. And putting in a guy like Pau Gasol does kind of the same exact things. Duncan is clearly a better defensive player. But the Spurs offense, when it runs super well, is when they have a big man in the middle that can pass. And Gasol is arguably the best passing big man in the NBA right now. I'm going to give Joel Embiid another couple years until he might take that crown. But I've always was a huge San Antonio fan. I thought they weren't given credit for being a really good team last year. They kind of just ran into the buzzsaw that was Oklahoma City Thunder with Durant and Westbrook going absolutely crazy at that point. But they got younger. They got a lot of good, you know, a lot of good players. You know, they got a lot of great reserve players. Jonathan Simmons is coming into his own. And I've been a huge Kawhi fan ever since he was at San Diego State. I was more shocked why people weren't exactly fans of him coming in the draft, because his major negative was he couldn't shoot. But, Rick, as you know, these are professional basketball organizations. You can eventually teach a guy how to shoot if he has every other piece and you know, every other tool in the toolbox. The interesting part is going to be this season is how Greg Popovich is going to stagger the minutes for key guys like Ginobili and Parker. Because those guys, if they can stay healthy enough, they provide a whole different dimension to San Antonio. And I'm gonna note two guys that I think are gonna have a bigger impact. David Bertans, who, you know, is a big guy. He has the range. He can make big shots. And Dwayne Dedmon, he was pretty much cast off in Orlando for a lot of those years, is now coming into his own as the backup center, essentially, to Gasol. So they got a lot of young guys, and we have to all remember a lot of these guys have played together. This isn't a team that essentially, you know, they lost their stalwart player and then they have nothing else.
That's exactly right. And the Spurs really are, in so many ways, right down to the surly nature of the head coach, the Patriots of the NBA, as far as finding guys from other organizations that you might not even give a second glance to, but Popovich will see that they can be a fit for what they're doing. So that's a very good point there. And on a side note with what you said about best passing big men, that is really going to be intriguing with Philly in the years to come here with Ben Simmons. And assuming that they don't play him at point guard, can you imagine Ben Simmons plus a true point guard out there plus Embiid if they decide to go that way? There might be no team in the league that's better at finding the open man than the Sixers once they get it going.
And I think they will at some point. And I've gone out on a limb and said that they could sneak into the playoffs this year, even though, you know, it's still pretty much a hodgepodge. But like I said, everyone was incredibly critical of Sam Hinkie about how he was doing it. Let's be honest, I know tanking is a dirty word in sports, but there are sometimes you have to get really, really bad to get really, really good. And at least so far with how Embiid has played, Saric has played well. I would rather be in a position like the Sixers where I have three or four horrid seasons and then give the opportunity to win instead of being a team like, let's say, well, I'll use an analogy from the mid-2000s, the Milwaukee Bucks, to where they would make it to the seventh or eighth seed and then lose in the first round. I would much rather be the team that my team could win a title or come close to winning a title than be a team that just constantly goes in and out every other season out of the playoffs.
You are completely correct. And as a Cleveland Browns fan, I too am hoping that I can trust the process in the same way that it's played out with the Sixers. And yeah, had Simmons been healthy the whole year, I might have joined you in the optimism that they might be able to sneak into a playoff spot. It'll nonetheless be interesting.
The East is still not that good. You can count maybe six teams that are pretty much guaranteed playoff spot teams. But if Philly can figure it out, they have a very, you know, decently composed roster. Obviously, it's not the best, and they're still trying to make acquisitions. And I've known Tyus Jones from Minnesota has been the name floated around forever now. But they really need a guy who can off-ball, you know, that can handle off of Simmons in those situations. But they're going to be really good, and they're going to be in the playoffs. If it's not this year, it's going to be next year. And it's absolutely bizarre to see, because I was traveling during that game, and I was able to watch the first half of it because the Wells Fargo Center, or whatever they call it right now, during those 2 years was pretty much vacant. There wasn't many people going to those games. It was around about 12,000 to 14,000. And just to see it completely filled with people was just – it was different. It's a different feeling, because I think, at least for most common NBA fans, unless you grew up during the AI era, Philadelphia hasn't been a good team. And it's nice to see the jolt of energy that the city now has to see a lot of these young guys and a lot of talent. This is not a situation where they tank and they didn't get anything from it. They have plenty of talent. They just have to figure out what the best course of action is with the guys they have.
They do indeed. And, again, there are so many things that can be summed up with the three simple words, it's the East. whether it be your sense that Philly could knock on the door of the playoffs earlier than people think, my overweening confidence in the Cavs to be able to get through no matter the obstacles, that kind of explains everything. It's the East, because all things really are possible if you are kind of pulling your thing together here and making it happen out there. In terms of the Western Conference, I think a lot of people sort of have it tiered off. I, at this point in time, I would guess that a lot of people are probably putting San Antonio on Golden State's tier, realizing that they wrote off the Spurs a little bit too early. And then below that, when you're looking at teams that most people don't think could get past the big two, but maybe could if either of the big two suffered injuries or they got the right matchups, my guess is that people would think that the next tier consists in whatever order of Oklahoma City, the Clippers, and the team out in your neck of the woods, the Portland Trail Blazers, which you called it a year ago that they would be a big surprise, and they were. What are your thoughts when you look at the teams that a lot of people have jostling for the 3, 4, and 5 seeds in the NBA playoffs this year?
I think it's going to be very interesting because no one really knows who the – because this is one of those rare times in the league, Rick, where we kind of know who the top four best teams in the league are. And right now in the West, it's sort of a hodgepodge of the Clippers, the Thunder, Portland, and then the team that everyone else seems to be the sexy pick to make the playoffs in the West is the Utah Jazz. And
right.
Each of those teams have their efficiencies and their deficiencies. Let's just lead off with the Clippers. The Clippers are probably the third best team in the West, but the issues that they have had at the small forward position, and then you have to remember, Paul missed a lot of time last season, Griffin a lot of time last season. You have a lot of injured guys, and it very seems like this is a team that's on their final legs. I know Paul and Griffin are going to be free agents coming up, and it feels like this is their last stand pretty much to make it efficient. I don't know how they match up with either Golden State or San Antonio, but if they could possibly get into a game with San Antonio, they have a very good chance to make the finals if that is essentially the Western Conference Finals. With Utah, I personally think they're a sleeper team. The real question for them is, again, offense. They have elite players in terms of Gordon Hayward and Derek Favors and Gobert. And they were able to acquire Joe Johnson in the offseason, George Hill. They got plenty of talent. The real question is there enough offense to make that team get to the next level? And I think there is. The real question, though, is that I still don't think, outside of maybe Joe Johnson, but even Joe Johnson's pushing up there in age, they don't have a legitimate go-to scorer at the end of the games. I know Hayward is their main star out there. I still need to see him being able to take over a game late to allow him to get into that rarefied air of a guy who can close a game by himself. Moving on very quickly,
right.
Oklahoma City is the most interesting team, I think, Rick, of everyone right now, because it's pretty much Russell Westbrook and the Russell Westbrookettes at this point. He's put together back-to-back games early in the season that have been pretty much incredible. The one issue for them, as you can probably guess, and it was the issue with them when they had Durant, they were very inconsistent on their other scoring measures. I know you have to give credit to their general manager, who for some Sam Presti, and making good deals to try and keep a lot of the young talent in there, getting Oladipo and Sabonis from the Magic. You have Enes Kanter. You have Cameron Payne coming off the bench at some point. The real question for them is that Russell Westbrook is pretty much going to have to play an 82-game season at 30-10-10. I'm not sure that works in the playoffs, because at some point a better team is going to be able to do that. And let's be honest, to use an analogy from their second game against Phoenix, even though they came back from that game, guys like Kyle Singler, Andre Roberson were getting chief minutes at the end of that game. I don't think Oklahoma City will be there yet, but I'm pretty sure. I think a lot of people thought they're going to lose Durant. It's pretty much over for them. But it feels like that if Westbrook and the rest of the team can mesh, they can do it. The problem is that Russell Westbrook is still Russell Westbrook, despite what anyone will say to you. He can make some spectacular stuff happen, but he can make some boneheaded plays at the same exact time that could cost them a game. And I feel that I don't trust Oklahoma City yet until they can put together a couple other guys that can be a little more consistent. So let me take a breath and we'll get to Portland. I think Portland's an interesting team. They should be, I would think, the best you know, the third best team in the West just because they have Lillard and you have McCollum. You have a lot of really good, young, talented players. I thought a lot of people were bashing them for taking Evan Turner, but I get the logic of what they're trying to do was they want a playmaker off their bench that can distribute the ball and to get other guys good shots. Because that was their real weakness last season, because if McCollum or Lillard were not on the floor, they could not create their own. They could not create the shots, because that's essentially what Lillard and McCollum do. They're high-volume type scorers. But having a guy like Evan Turner, who essentially is a guy that I think we all kind of projected as a tweener in the league, is kind of, you know, he's a guy who can make mid-range shots, he can pass, he can make, you know, correct decisions. And it's really going to come down to, I think, about is there big man play. Myers Leonard is coming off of an injury. Azeeley is still dealing with his foot problems. And the real question is their hodgepodge of big men going to be enough to help them get over the hump at the end of the day?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people are kind of wondering that. And, again, yeah, as far as how Turner fits in Portland, I think a lot of times teams find that they have to, quote-unquote, overpay somebody who fits well into their system and gives them what they need. And that had to be what they were looking at, as opposed to if you were just looking at a statistical breakdown of Turner's career and thinking he'd be worth the money that way. Clearly, they were looking at it in terms of their specific needs, as you pointed out. Last question,
right,
on the West for you, kind of like what – oh, yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, no. I think also, too, is that we also are in the off-season of big money anyway, so everyone freaking out about how much someone's getting paid is not really, you know, I don't think it's a valid reason when pretty much everyone was getting cash thrown at them. I was shocked I didn't get a 10-day at that point. They were giving
well,
money
when you're
away
looking at guys like, yeah, well, guys like Timofey Mozgov that couldn't even get into the rotation in the NBA Finals, albeit he probably wasn't 100% all or most of last year, but getting $16 million a year and some of the deals that were given out.
No, that
I mean, really
also
told
Mike
you
Conley
something.
Getting the highest deal of all, of arguably of, you know, of the history of the NBA, or it was on par at least with some of those numbers. I love Mike Conley as much as the next guy, but anyone saying that Mike Conley is the best point guard in the NBA is crazy.
Right. And prior to making his first All-Star game, which it's not a matter of, oh, well, he's only been in the league 2 years. No, he's been in the league since, 08 now. So,
Yeah, roughly.
07, 08. So, yeah, that really kind of tells you something there. In looking at some of the younger teams in the Western Conference, last question for you on the West is kind of the same thing as what I was asking about with the East. When you're looking at the young teams taking a step forward this year, obviously not going to challenge to do much of anything. And unlike even in the Eastern Conference, where some of the young teams, if they get hot, could sneak into the second round, realistically, with the top five teams we've already talked about previously, there's not a path for any of these guys to sneak into the second round. But just to make the playoffs would really be something here. The first couple of years of the Browse career in New Orleans have been sadly kind of wasted. People used to point to what happened with the Cavs when LeBron was there the first time around. This makes it look like LeBron won the title 3 years in, the way that Anthony Davis and his production has been wasted in New Orleans, albeit in fairness, he's been hurt part of that time. But you look at New Orleans, which still doesn't look poised to necessarily take a great step forward this year. The Lakers, the young talent that they have there that they continue to accrue, adding Luke Walton to the mix, who brings his own youthful and fairly successful perspective to the mix. And one of the things that I think is most intriguing to me, the young team that might be the quickest to take a step forward in the NBA, albeit their start has been a little slow, Tibbs going to Minnesota and inheriting Towns and Wiggins there. That, to me, I said to somebody just the other day, the Cavs, by the time their run of being champions or championship contenders is over, we may have to deal with Minnesota before our clock is done. We may be facing them in the finals at that point. So at some point in the next several years. So what do you think when you're looking at the young teams in the West that are the most intriguing?
Well, there are plenty of intriguing young teams in the West. I'll just gloss over a couple really quickly. Some of the ones you did mention, I mean, New Orleans had one of the worst runs of injuries, I think, in the league's history last season when they started, I believe, if I'm correct, 43 different starting lineups. And they have a lot of good young talent, and they have a lot of guys, but it really just feels like it's a hodgepodge right now. They're trying to find someone to help trying to figure it out. Buddy Hield, it's early. They're bringing him off the bench. I have no idea what to think of him at this point. It would be pretty much, I would think, a mini miracle for them to make the playoffs, but they do have talent on the team. You have Drew Holiday, Tyreek Evans, if they both come back healthy. You got Ajinka and the Seek down low. So they have the pieces. It's just, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to put everything together at that point. I think Minnesota is a very interesting candidate. They're clearly the most talented team in the West and the most talented young team in the West at this period of time. And they got a lot of good pieces. The real question is Tibbs, as you know, too, in Chicago and in his other stops, it takes him a little bit of time to put his system in place. And it feels almost like to me that this might be a wash season for Minnesota, because I heard a lot of people were on their bandwagon in the offseason. I think that's going to happen. And I think, you know, we all think they're going to make that next level, and I'm pretty sure they are. The real question is that what are they going to do with certain pieces? The two obvious ones are Ricky Rubio and Zach LaVine. LaVine has pretty much the highest ceiling of pretty much anyone, I think, on their team outside of Towns. But the real question for him is that he's a floater type player. Not really a great shooter, but he can do pretty much anything else on the floor that you need to ask of him. And I think at some point Ricky Rubio might get dealt, because obviously they want to start Chris Dunn, even despite his struggles in the preseason. But everything's brighter in Minnesota. The one team I think you didn't mention that I think actually can make the playoffs right away is Denver. They have a lot of good young talent on that team. Moutier is an underrated point guard. You have Jokic, who had a great Olympics, is playing well. You got a lot of good medium to raw young talent. Jamal Murray was picked up in the draft. They got Gary Harris. If there was a team that to sneak into that top eight that didn't, you know, that wasn't there before, I think Denver is most likely the most valid candidate. And give Michael Malone credit. They brought this team together with a lot of guys, especially that their scouting staff, they arguably, you could say, that they have the best European scouting staff in the NBA, maybe outside of San Antonio. And it feels that I think at some point they're going to make the next jump. They either are just one player away or they're just another season away. But I wouldn't be surprised if they made it. They played some really close games early on this year, and they have the talent to match up with a lot of teams in the West.
Very interesting. We'll have to keep an eye on that one here. Very quickly, we're low on time here. Prediction for the season here. I said before the season, head over heart, I thought Golden State over Cleveland in six in the finals. I've already reconsidered that. I could honestly make a great case for the Cavs at this point. I'm not going to back away from it at this point here. I'll say that, but as I said before, I think the Cavs have a great chance of doing it. What would be your lean at the moment?
This is really hard, and I think a lot of people could argue this situation. I'm not a huge Golden State person. I wasn't a huge Golden State person last year. I thought they'd be upset in the, you know, some early in the finals or in the second round. But it feels to me that this almost feels like a rematch of a finals gone past between San Antonio and Cleveland. But I think this time Cleveland's going to get the victory in six, and then we're going to set ourselves up for either another Golden State Cleveland matchup or another San Antonio Cleveland matchup. So I think the league, despite anything, you know, that's been going on with, you know, people wanting certain matchups or not, they just look, you know, they're going to be happy with whatever they get at the end of the day. So
you got to think so. Oh, that would be outstanding. I personally would love to see that kind of an outcome. And I want to get the plug in here. Obviously, before the show ends, hashtag basketball detectives on Periscope. People need to check out that great basketball semi-scripted semi-improv comedy show. A great thing here. I understand that there's going to be a little bit of that coming to Facebook Live as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're still working on all that stuff right now, Rick, and we're intrigued to see what the future holds for basketball detectives and the future, too, with the entire live streaming community as well.
Yes. You have been making some great strides in that, and I've been monitoring the progress very closely. Some great stuff going on there. And, of course, that NBALotteryPick.com, people can continue to check that out there. Your fine work. Always love breaking down the NBA and other subjects with you on the show here, my friend. Thank you so much for lending your expertise for the 2016-2017 season.
No problem, Rick. Happy Halloween, and do it for the vine for the final time.
All right. Going to do it for the land. Both the Indians, hopefully, in the near term, and the Cavs, one more time. As Carmelo said to LeBron, you did it for the land, I do it for the money in my hand. But that's the story of the league right now. Thanks for joining us, Ben, and thank you, everybody, for checking us out for FDH Lounge, mini episode number 775.